And welcome to today's program. I'm Dr. John Mascarenhas, a professor of medicine at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. I'm joined by Dr. Sandra Curtin, an assistant professor of clinical medicine at the University of Arizona. And these are our disclosures. So today, our learning objectives will focus on alignment of patient presentation and symptomatology with second-line options in myelofibrosis through a series of case scenarios, and outline importance and role of shared decision-making and patient caregiver education in the treatment of myelofibrosis.
So thank you for that, Dr. Mascarenhas. I will start by just giving a brief overview of shared decision-making and try to tailor that conversation around those individuals with the diagnosis of myelofibrosis. So we hear a lot about shared decision-making, and there are basic principles that are important. I think the bottom line is this should include a patient and caregiver-centric communication strategy. And in order to do that, it must be tailored to the individual patient. We really need to talk about determination or of individual goals of care at the outset of that tailoring process. And then really, this is going to require for those with myelofibrosis an assessment of that symptom burden, quality of life, and should be limited in terms of any implicit bias. So what we believe a patient should think or might want should be left out of that, really that patient-centric approach. This requires a bi-directional and dynamic exchange of information. So it's not one visit, it's not one decision. It's a process that we need to incorporate over time. It should be intentional. You really need to be thinking about this approach when you're meeting with patients and their caregivers. It requires a team. This is a team sport. Taking care of these patients is very complicated. And so we really need to leverage all of the members of our team. And over time, we're going to have to build on those patient experiences and how they basically evolve through their ability to make these kinds of decisions. That requires a level of trust. Still today, we have this discordant perspective telling us that we need to continue to work at this skill. We also have a very rapidly evolving treatment landscape. That's great news in terms of offering hope to patients, but it also complicates that conversation that we are required to have with them in explaining these options. There are gaps in treatment decision-making tools and resources, and certainly for these patients, the symptom burden and their quality of life can impact their ability to really fully engage. We have other barriers. I'll talk more about that in a moment. And then the forever unchanging limitations of our electronic medical records and really being able to find information easily and communicate among the team. So this is a slide that I've created just to really try to talk about the complexity of shared decision making. And it really requires that we talk or understand and consider disease and treatment related factors for these patients. That may be things the simple process of risk stratification, transplant eligibility, clinical trial eligibility, their disease tempo, and similar other factors. Patient-related factors, that may be their personal goals of care, their access to health information in the digital era, frailty and comorbidities, and medications, finances. And then there are all these organizational or system-related factors that we may have some or no control over, including workflows and scope of services and our IT departments. So really understanding this is a very complicated process. It requires consideration of all of these elements. So what can we do? First and foremost, build trust. That requires that we listen. We always say talk less, listen more. We need to understand where patients are coming from. What are their challenges and barriers? How can we support self-efficacy, their belief that they can be a partner in their care? Some patients want to do that more than others, and knowing where they're at in that process is important to tailoring your conversations with them. And then fostering those communication skills. This can be tricky as we're all forced to face the computer and type and fill in the blanks. But turning around and looking patients in the eye is something very simple that can really aid in their feeling like they're being heard and understood. Their health literacy, and I don't mean necessarily readability, but their ability to take in information, synthesize it, and then apply that toward their own decision making is something that we need to understand and foster. Having early conversations about supportive care and palliative care to begin to really have them feel like we're looking at the whole scope of what they need in their process of care, and then understanding those barriers that I just discussed. So I'll turn it back over to you now so we can go through some cases.
So what I'm hoping to do in the remainder of the program is to use case presentations in order to facilitate the application of shared decision-making into practice. And we have several cases that I think will highlight some of these aspects when treating patients with myelofibrosis. And this is the first case of a patient, SV, who is a 78-year-old gentleman, initially presented with JAK2 mutant transfusion-independent DIPSS intermediate 2 primary myelofibrosis with a massive tender spleen measuring 10 centimeters below the left costal margin and mild night sweats and lower extremity bone pain, usually at night, that would disturb quality of sleep. He initially enjoyed 3 years of ruxolitinib at a maximum tolerated dose of 20 milligrams twice daily, but over the last 3 months has regrowth of his spleen from 3 centimeters at its smallest to now 8 centimeters below the left costal margin, and it's more tender, and he's noticing that he's unable to finish his meals as he once did. His white count is 13,000, hemoglobin 8.8, platelets 199,000, and there's no blasts in the peripheral blood smear. So what are your management considerations in a patient who's been on ruxolitinib, who initially enjoyed spleen and symptom benefit for a period of time, and now is losing that aspect from both from a spleen and mainly from a spleen perspective? So in this case, the options would be to increase the dose of ruxolitinib, reduce the dose of ruxolitinib, switch to fedratinib, switch to azacitidine, or refer to hematopoietic stem cell transplantation. Please vote on the most appropriate choice for this patient. So in this case, option C, which is the switch to fedratinib, is likely the best option, as increasing the dose of ruxolitinib is unlikely to garner better spleen and symptom benefit at this point and was the maximally tolerated dose for the patient. Lowering the dose of ruxolitinib would likely reduce the symptom and spleen benefit that you still have. Switching to azacitidine, which is not an approved drug for myelofibrosis, is usually relegated to patients who have progressive or clonal evolution with increasing blasts or leukemic transformation. And unfortunately for this patient is too advanced in age to be a viable candidate for hematopoietic stem cell transplantation, which remains the only curative option. So of these options, switching to fedratinib is the most reasonable option in order to use a second-line JAK2 inhibitor to regain spleen control. So the two options for first-line therapy with a JAK inhibitor for platelets greater than 50,000 would include ruxolitinib or fedratinib. And if patients don't have a response, either a sufficient response at a maximally tolerated dose with either drug in terms of spleen or symptom benefit, or have an initial response and lose response, or don't tolerate the drug due to cytopenias or extramedullary toxicity, then one can switch to the alternative therapy, so from ruxolitinib to fedratinib, or from fedratinib to ruxolitinib, and also pacritinib is now a third option for the second-line patient population. So there are three approved JAK inhibitors, as I'm showing you here on the left. Two of those inhibitors, ruxolitinib since 2011 and fedratinib since 2019, were approved for patients with intermediate and high-risk disease that had a platelet count greater than 50,000. And then pacritinib that was approved in February of this year, February 28th to be specific, for patients with platelet counts less than 50,000. And you'll see that there are still drugs that are in development that are JAK inhibitors, most notably momelotinib, which has data now from the MOMENTUM study that was presented at ASCO and EHA 2022, demonstrating symptom, spleen, and even anemia responses in patients who have been previously treated with ruxolitinib that continue to have spleen, symptom burden, and anemia. There are a number of drugs on the right that are unfortunately have stalled in clinical development, mostly because of toxicity, sometimes because of lack of sufficient activity. Ruxolitinib is an excellent drug. In the majority of patients that are treated with this oral JAK1/2 inhibitor, they do garner benefit from spleen and symptom burden. However, if you look at the prospective studies and the follow-up, at a median of 3 years, half the patients have discontinued therapy for a variety of different reasons. At 5 years, 85% of patients have discontinued therapy. And this leaves an unmet need, because once you've discontinued therapy with ruxolitinib, there is unmet spleen and symptom burden, often cytopenias, and unfortunately, multiple studies have shown a poor outcome from a survival perspective. What I'm showing you here is the data from Jakarta 2, which was an open-label phase 2 study of fedratinib, which is a selective JAK2 inhibitor. It spares JAK1, which is different from ruxolitinib, which is an equipotent JAK1/2 inhibitor. And in this single-arm study, fedratinib was administered at 400 milligrams daily, which is the approved dose, to patients who had at least 14 days of prior ruxolitinib therapy and were either intolerant or refractory to the drug. And what I'm showing really is the bottom line of this approach of sequentially giving another JAK inhibitor, in this case, fedratinib in the Jakarta 2, where despite the previous exposure to ruxolitinib, 30% of patients hit an SVR 35%, and almost 30% of patients hit a TSS 50% or better, really indicating that one can still salvage spleen and symptom burden even with a drug from the same class that differs from the original JAK inhibitor. And down below you can see that if you look at platelet counts between 50 to 100,000, which this trial allowed on, or greater than 100,000, the response rates were more or less the same. So one could still achieve spleen response and even symptom benefit even in these patients with more modest thrombocytopenia between 50 and 100,000. So this is data that would support second-line use of fedratinib after ruxolitinib, particularly when trying to capture spleen, but also symptom burden. And here I'm showing the waterfall plot that gives you a sense in the patients with platelets between 50 and 100,000, what the spleen volume response rate looked like. Essentially, every patient except one enjoyed reduction in their spleen volume. And I would make the argument that even patients who have a 20% reduction in their spleen volume will likely feel better as a result in terms of the complaint like our gentleman had of early satiety or discomfort or mobility. So the next case is a case of SG. She is a 75-year-old female with CALR mutated, MYSEC intermediate risk, post-essential thrombocythemia related myelofibrosis, with a 5-centimeter spleen and a hemoglobin of 9 grams per deciliter and platelets of 105,000. She was started on ruxolitinib 10 milligrams twice daily, and the spleen is now non-palpable. Her fatigue and malaise have significantly better, but she does bruise extensively. Her hemoglobin is 7.1 and platelets are now 43,000 from 105,000. When the dose of ruxolitinib was dropped to 5 milligrams twice daily to avoid red cell transfusion receipt and worsening thrombocytopenia, the problem is the spleen started to worsen in size and caused pressure and early satiety, and fatigue started to limit her daily activities. So what are the management considerations in a patient who is enjoying benefit of ruxolitinib but has to be dose reduced for worsening cytopenias and then is losing that benefit from a spleen and symptom perspective at a lower dose of ruxolitinib? So in this case, what would you do? Would you maintain the dose of ruxolitinib at 5 milligrams twice daily? Would you try to go back up to 10 milligrams twice daily? Would you switch to fedratinib? Would you switch to pacritinib? Or refer to hematopoietic stem cell transplantation? Please vote. So the right answer here would be to switch to pacritinib, which is a JAK2, IRAK1, ACVR1 inhibitor that has been shown in clinical development to be less myelosuppressive and offers a nice alternative to low-dose ruxolitinib in patients who have to dose reduce because of cytopenias, where you can deliver the full dose of pacritinib in this patient population. Although fedratinib does have data, as I showed you from the Jakarta 2 study, with platelets between 50 and 100,000, this patient now has platelets less than 50,000, and fedratinib has not been approved or studied extensively in this patient population. Here are the PERSIST studies, PERSIST 1 up on top and PERSIST 2. These are randomized phase 3 studies of pacritinib. In PERSIST 1, these were patients who had never seen a JAK inhibitor previously and were randomized in a 2-to-1 fashion to pacritinib 400 milligrams daily or best available therapy, which excluded ruxolitinib. In PERSIST 2, this was an interesting and important study because it took the worst players that we see, the patients with platelet counts less than 100,000. They could have seen a prior JAK inhibitor, and half of them did. And they would randomize 1-to-1-to-1 to pacritinib 400 milligrams daily, 200 milligrams twice daily, or best available therapy, which could include ruxolitinib. And again, almost half the patients required received ruxolitinib in the BAT arm. Here it was a very stringent co-primary endpoint at 24 weeks of spleen volume reduction of 35% or greater and TSS 50% improvement or greater. And if we look at the results from the PERSIST 2, the low platelet population, so exclusive to patients with platelet counts less than 100,000, the spleen volume response rate at week 24 was 22% versus 3% in the BAT arm at 200 milligrams twice daily. And this was the now approved dose as of February 28th of 2022. The symptom improvement at 200 milligrams twice daily was 35% versus 14%. And if you drill down and look at specifically those patients with less than 50,000, that's where the label doesn't cover for ruxolitinib or fedratinib, the SVR 35% was 29% versus 3%, and the TSS 50% was 26% versus 9%. So here there's data for the first time in low platelets where you could give at the full intended dose of the drug spleen and symptom benefit. Interestingly, importantly, and increasingly recognized that pacritinib is a less myelosuppressive option. It also inhibits ACVR1, and ACVR1 has been linked to hepcidin expression level. And this was first noted with momelotinib, the JAK1/2 inhibitor that was presented in the MOMENTUM study results this summer. But this drug also inhibits ACVR1, and between ACVR1 inhibition and IRAK1 inhibition, this might explain why 25% of the patients who received the approved dose, 200 milligrams twice daily of pacritinib, attained a clinical improvement in anemia. So these were patients who had at least a 2 gram per deciliter increase in hemoglobin or converted from transfusion dependence to independence. And if you look on the right, the mean number of units of red cells that were being received by these patients decreased from 1.06 per month at baseline to 0.67 units per month. And this is important and shouldn't be overlooked, because decreasing the amount of transfusion burden and freeing the patient up from the burden, and the patient's family, from the burden of being in the cancer center or the hospital or the office getting transfusions, which can often consume a whole day and is very tiring and can be discouraging, is a significant benefit. So even in the absence of transfusion independence, I would argue reducing the amount of transfusional needs for patients and freeing them up is a significant benefit to these patients. The next case is Cece. She is an 85-year-old woman with triple negative, meaning lacking JAK2, CALR, MPL. She has ASXL1, primary myelofibrosis, initially treated for severe systemic symptoms and spleen pressure with an associated early satiety and weight loss. She enjoyed immediate spleen and symptom benefit for 1 year with ruxolitinib at 10 milligrams twice daily, but now she's red blood cell transfusion dependent every 2 weeks, and platelet count is 110,000. Her spleen is not palpable, she has no systemic symptoms, and she really hates receiving transfusions and the toll it takes on her family. So what are the management considerations for a patient who is still enjoying on their JAK inhibitor, ruxolitinib, spleen and symptom benefit, but continues to have an unmet need of anemia and transfusion dependence? So what would you do in this case? Would you increase the dose of ruxolitinib, decrease the dose of ruxolitinib, switch to fedratinib, add an erythropoiesis stimulating agent, add an erythropoiesis maturation agent, or refer to hematopoietic stem cell transplantation? Please indicate your answer. So the right answer here, I think, is E, to add an erythropoiesis maturation agent. And probably unfairly, I didn't mention that this patient's EPO level was in fact elevated, because if it was low, less than 500, definitely less than 200, maybe a consideration to adding an ESA like Aranesp or Procrit would be reasonable. But in this case, this patient had received a lot of transfusions and the EPO level was already high. And unfortunately, adjusting the dose of ruxolitinib will probably not keep the benefit of spleen and symptom and maintain anemia response. You're going to lose something. Switching to fedratinib will probably not benefit the patient, because fedratinib also has a myelosuppressive profile that's similar to ruxolitinib. And unfortunately, at this advanced stage, she's not a real candidate for transplant. So let's explore why an EMA, an erythropoiesis maturation agent, might make sense. So this is a study, a phase two study of luspatercept, which is an activin ligand trap, which is part of the TGF-beta superfamily, that when inhibiting this protein, one downregulates SMAD signaling. And what this appears to do is relieve the repression on maturation of red cells. So it's a double negative. It allows for red cells to mature. And this study was evaluating patients with myelofibrosis who were either receiving ruxolitinib or not receiving ruxolitinib, and then were further stratified by whether they were receiving transfusions or transfusion independent. And it was giving this subcutaneous injection of luspatercept every 3 weeks, much like you give Aranesp, to these patients to see if there's one goal in mind: can you improve the hemoglobin? So this is not a therapy that's directed at spleen and symptom benefit, but one in fact that is to alleviate the anemia. And to jump to the chase, where the drug really was probably most beneficial were in the patients who were receiving ruxolitinib who were transfusion dependent. About a third of the patients achieved transfusion independence, and almost 50% of the patients had a 50% or greater reduction in their red blood cell transfusion need during the study follow-up. So this was a drug that could be added very easily and comfortably to ruxolitinib to address that one aspect that may not be met in the given individual of anemia. And it was very well tolerated, with very few significant treatment emergent adverse events. And for the most part, if you didn't respond then within 9 weeks, you were probably unlikely to respond. So one could imagine that one wouldn't need to sit on this for 6 months to necessarily understand whether they would have the benefit of this drug. One of the points you made early on, which I think is super important that I'd like to convey, is if you don't have the conversation with the patient about what their expectations and goals are, you can really go in opposite directions. And I think that's important, to sort of set the expectation and understanding up front so that everyone's on the same page, because I see frequently that doesn't happen.
No, I agree with you. And I really try to, set expectations at each visit and give people homework, the patients and their caregivers, to say, we've talked about a lot of things. I summarize our conversation in, like bullet points. And then I give them things to take away, to talk about amongst themselves and bring back. And, it can be challenging when there are different people seeing the patients in visits, but I find that just sort of reviewing back what we talked about in a summary at the end of each visit, albeit some of them are short, but then giving them some homework to go home and fosters engagement. And then you ask them when they come back, we talked about this. I put it in my notes so that if somebody else is seeing the patient, they can follow up on that conversation. But I think they feel like, okay, I'm part of this. I'm really part of this conversation.
So in summary, in 2022, moving into 2023, there are now three JAK inhibitors that are approved, likely a fourth on the horizon with momelotinib. And what we're seeing and appreciating is that there are niches for these JAK inhibitors, and that importantly, one needs to be cognizant and aware of and consider the potential to sequence these JAK inhibitors in order to address spleen and symptom burden and maybe even anemia burden. So ruxolitinib will likely remain the first line option for most patients. If platelets have less than 50,000, pacritinib is a really good option and the only approved option for these patients. If patients do not do well with ruxolitinib for whatever reason and have to discontinue therapy, then fedratinib is an excellent option, particularly to address ongoing and unresolved splenomegaly and or symptom burden. For patients who have good control on their JAK inhibitor with spleen and symptom at bay, but anemia still persists, I think those patients may be very well suited in the future for the addition of luspatercept, which is the activin ligand trap. It is approved for transfusion-dependent lower-risk myelodysplastic syndrome and not yet approved for myelofibrosis, but is in phase 3 testing, evaluating the ability to address anemia in patients receiving ruxolitinib or fedratinib that continue to have this unmet need. The future looks very bright for myelofibrosis as we have multiple approved and expanding options for JAK inhibitor treatment for myelofibrosis, but also what wasn't touched upon today are the many ongoing late-phase clinical trials evaluating combination therapies with JAK inhibitors and other relevant pathway inhibitors, whether it's BET inhibitors, BCL2 inhibitors, or MDM2 inhibitors. So there are a number of different options that I think will continue to improve upon our ability to treat our myelofibrosis patients. And some of these options are even now looking at survival as an endpoint, such as imetelstat in the IMPACT-MF study after ruxolitinib failure. So stay tuned, because there's a lot on the horizon. But in the time being, for those patients, for those people in practice in the community taking care of myelofibrosis patients, just be aware that there are a number of JAK inhibitors that can serve the purpose of improving quality of life through management of spleen and symptom burden, and in some cases even less myelosuppression and anemia responses.